From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. On Monday, the U.S. Open begins. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the winner of 8 Grand Slam singles tournaments and an Olympic gold medal, Andre Agassi. He'll tell us why he hated tennis and thinks he played for all the wrong reasons. And he'll tell us about some of the surprises in his memoir, now out in paperback, namely that he briefly used crystal meth and lied when he tested positive. We'll also hear about his famous long mullet and what it was like playing with pain. Pain that eventually forced him to retire. Also, critic-at-large John Powers reviews the new gangster film from France, Marine, Killer Instinct. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The U.S. Open tennis tournament begins Monday, and the memoir by Andre Agassi, one of the most electrifying players to compete there, is now out in paperback. Those are two good reasons to revisit Terry's 2009 interview with Agassi, recorded when his surprise-filled memoir, Open, was first published. Although he won 869 matches, 8 Grand Slam titles, an Olympic gold medal, and was 5th on the all-time list, Agassi says he hated tennis with a dark and secret passion. He confesses that he used crystal meth, and that, when his urine tested positive for the drug, he lied about how he ingested it. Then, there's the confession that his famous long mullet, which helped define his image, was part hairpiece. But Agassi's memoir is also filled with insights about the game, what it's like to win and to lose, and the physical toll being a professional tennis player took on his body, forcing him to retire at age 36 after the 2006 U.S. Open. The memoir is written with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer J.R. Moringer. Agassi says he asked Moringer to collaborate with him because he loved Moringer's memoir, The Tender Bar.
Andre Agassi, welcome to Fresh Air. I have to tell you, I really love the opening of your book. There's so many memoirs, sports memoirs included, that start with like the moment of triumph and then tell you how they got there. And your memoir starts with you in incredible pain. on the way to what will be your final match. And you're 36 at this point. It's in the year 2006. You feel like you're 96 physically. It's just before the U.S. Open. Why were you in such pain then?
Well, physically speaking, I was in pain on a lot of different levels, emotionally trying to come to terms with a real roller coaster of a whirl of a life that I lived, and trying to understand myself through that process. But physically, I was in a lot of pain because I had just been through, you know, over nearly 3 decades of just a lot of wear and tear on my body, and my spine was kind of seizing up on me as moments continued on the tennis court. And to physically be so limited and to be out there competing in the U.S. Open was traumatizing.
When you play with pain, how does it alter your game?
It alters your decision-making. You know, you understand what your limitations are, so if you can't quite bend as low or reach as far, you know, it forces you to be in better position for the ball, which forces you to make more educated guesses out there. You have to start leaning more. You have to start guessing more. Part of the reason why I got aced a lot on the tennis court is because I didn't have the lateral coverage, and so as a result, I would have to take these educational guesses and start leaning so I can be close enough to the ball to hit it with a purpose that you know that you want to hit it with.
So, you know, in your opening chapter, you describe at the U.S. Open, your final U.S. Open, you're playing against Marcos Baghdatis, and he's a young tennis player at this point. He's like 21. He grew up with pictures of you on his bedroom wall. He patterned his game after yours. He's at the beginning of his career. You're at the very end of your career. What was it like playing against him at that point?
Well, it was brutal. You know, it was beyond the physical limitations that I felt, and beyond the fact that his game was a game that was designed like mine, which means we were going to play basically the most brutal form of the sport, which is going to be toe-to-toe, pounding on each other, and we knew there's going to be long rallies since neither one of us really had an overpowering serve. So I knew I was going to be in for a physical a battle unless everything went absolutely perfectly. But beyond that, you know, stepping onto a court and not knowing if this is the last time you're ever gonna do this, thinking quite possibly this is the last time. I sort of challenge any industry, any person in any industry, to imagine what it's like to get to a point of your life where you say, you know, I've done this my whole life, and today will be the last time I do it, the last article I write, the last radio show I host, the last, you know, interview I give. It is daunting. So emotionally, I was going through quite a roller coaster.
And to make that match particularly more incredible, your opponent was having physical problems too. Marcos Baghdatis was having,
cramps.
Yeah, he had problems with a strained quad.
His problems I earned that day, to be quite honest. You know, physically it turned into a huge battle, and I was actually getting him quite fatigued. And early in the fifth set, when he had seized momentum of the match and we had been out there for a number of hours, he called a trainer out to help with his quad because his quad was starting to cramp. And I knew he was running on a clock just like I was.
And when the game is over, you're both lying on a table in pain, alone in a room together. So at that point, is he like your opponent, your rival, or do you feel this connection? Because, I mean, he's this young guy who patterned himself on you. He's going through pain like you're going through pain. Like, you're so connected and so opposed to each other at this moment.
Yeah, and also on the court, you know, I mean, it's that net strangely connects you. It's you're so connected to somebody for many hours out there on a tennis court in front of the world and on that stage. And when both of you physically push yourself to places you never thought you can go, and he's cramping on the tennis court and your back is starting to seize up and you're walking to the locker room and he can hardly walk and your back's contorting the closer you get to the locker room, and the next thing you know, you just drop your bag and you can't walk any further and he can't walk any further, and you have people that come around and help lift you onto this table and lay me on a bag of ice, and people that start stretching him out, and every time they stretch one part of his body, you know, you flex the other. It's the way our body works. You stretch your quad, your hamstring flexes, and you stretch your hamstring, your quad flexes, and every time a muscle would flex, it cramps, and he's screaming in pain. I'm screaming in pain because I can't breathe. The muscles had spasmed so much it had kind of pulled against my diaphragm, and I was having a hard time breathing, and we just begged everybody to leave the room and let us be, because there's nothing to do but wait for the doctors. And while we were doing this, we're looking at this TV above our heads at 2 o'clock in the morning. You're lying under Arthur Ashe Stadium with an opponent that you bludgeoned, and he had done the same to you, and you know, you're watching yourself run around this court accomplishing a level of tennis that you've never that you very rarely get to experience, and I see the hand move out to the left of me, and I look over, and in pain he's holding his hand out, and in pain I hold mine, and we kind of hold hands watching the fierce battle that we had kind of just gone through. And you know, it was a crazy moment for me, and it's just, I'll remember it the rest of my life.
We should mention you won that particular match.
I got over the finish line. You know, I won a lot that day. He gave me one of the greatest memories I think I've ever had on a tennis court.
But this was like your last big tournament, the last U.S. Open. So as you were entering all of this, you write that you were thinking, let this be over. And you were also thinking, I'm not ready for it to be over. You wanted to retire at the same time you wanted to continue. I think this is not an uncommon conflict for people who are facing the end of something and have to decide if it's over yet. Can you talk about what that conflict was like for you?
Well, that conflict started when I was a young boy. You know, I never chose tennis. My father certainly pushed it on me in a very disciplined way. It was what we did as kids in our house. You wake up, you play tennis, you brush your teeth in that order, and I was always introduced as the future number one player in the world, and we would go out on the tennis court every day and hit balls endlessly and tirelessly, and I resented how it changed the mood of our house when I either won or lost, or I either practiced well or didn't.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andre Agassi, the tennis star who was a ranked number one during part of his career, and he's written a memoir called Open, an autobiography. You say you never really chose to play tennis. It was kind of forced on you by your father, who was, among other things, a tennis fanatic, and he kind of worked you to the bone. And talk about like your father's obsession with tennis and how that played out through him trying to train you.
Yeah, well, my father is an Armenian immigrant who was raised in Tehran. He's a Christian Armenian raised in Muslim Tehran, and spent much of his young youth fighting on the streets. His mother was rather abusive, and as a punishment would make him wear sometimes hand-me-down girls' clothes to school, which caused boys to, you know, tease. And he fought since he was, as long as I've played tennis, he has fought, and he finally turned that into a formal form of fighting and became a boxer in Golden Gloves, and won the Golden Gloves a couple times, boxed in 2 Olympics. But he came to America not speaking English, putting himself through school and feeling like the world was always against him. And his one thing he wanted for his children was the American dream, was really the quickest way to the American dream. And tennis was the one sport that he really connected to with boxing, because it was like boxing except without the gloves and without the contact. And he was a good boxer, but he used to break his hands a lot. So I think he responded to tennis because it was like you can beat somebody up, but you don't have to get hurt. And he had this real passion for tennis and believed that it was going to be what brings us success. And he didn't have choice in his life, and he was convinced the American dream would give us choice in our lives. And that passion was relentless, not just towards tennis, but just who he is. It's in his bones to work. It's in his bones to not cut corners. It's in his bones repetition, and it's in his bones to fight the world. And that's one thing my dad definitely did.
Describe his ball machine, the Dragon, that he drilled you with.
It was fierce. It stood many feet taller than me. It was, it had a black base to it, and it had a long aluminum tubular neck that stretched up, it was probably 7 or 8 feet, and then it had a long tubular nose that sort of shot towards you, kind of angling down, and this ball would kind of get sucked into this base of this machine, and it would build up pressure. It was one of these early ball machines that sort of needed to block the air around the ball before the air would eventually just push that thing through the narrow aluminum tubing, and it would make really sick sounds as it kind of sucked this ball into its gut. But he would push this thing as close to the net as possible, and then he would stand behind me and kind of push me as close to the baseline as possible, and then he would crank this thing up. And when that thing finally shot off, I make an analogy, it's like how a bullet gets shot out of a gun. And sure enough, when that ball came out, it was coming out about 110 miles an hour and coming out at a trajectory that was nearly impossible to deal with in a sea of tennis balls that were around me.
And how many how many balls would you have to hit a day about?
It was into the thousands. It was into the thousands. It was hours upon hours. And my father, he's a mathematician. He was always a genius at math. Came easy for him. He was a guy that believed in numbers. He believed in percentages. He believed in angles and geometry, and was fascinated by the game for those reasons as well. But the one thing he definitely believed about numbers is if you hit 2,500 balls a day, you'll hit he figured you're going to hit 1,000,000 balls over a certain period of time, which is about a year. And he just figured anybody that hits 1,000,000 balls a year cannot be beat. And one day you're going to get to enjoy what it is I saw at the local professional tournament that used to come to town, a wheelbarrow full of silver dollars getting wheeled out with Caesar and Cleopatra on hand as well. It was an image I think that he never forgot. Certainly I haven't.
Tennis star Andre Agassi speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2009 interview with tennis star Andre Agassi. His memoir, called Open, is now out in paperback.
Now, you went to a tennis camp in Florida. You grew up in Las Vegas, but your father sent you to this tennis camp, and then you also had to go to a school. So you went to an academy that you hated. You hated the tennis camp. You describe it as a glorified prison camp. Why? Because you were drilled so incessantly, and also the food was so bad.
Well, those were two of many reasons. Really, it was built on an old tomato farm, and it just had rows of tennis courts. And you know, more than anything, the prison of it was the prison of having tennis start to really come with a huge cost in my life, which is not even being able to be home, which is, you know, having your kind of life taken away, having to raise yourself at 13 years old. So that a lot of my perspectives then were just built through that fear. But there were hard reasons why. I mean, we lived in rickety bunks in buildings that were named like prison blocks. It was C building and A building, and you know, we had a strict schedule with strict rules, and we had to be up and go to a cafeteria with horrible food. You're fighting to get to the cafeteria first from other boys and girls. You're fighting to get to the shower before your bunk mates get to it, because the hot water lasts for about 12 minutes. You know, you're fighting to get a seat on the school bus that was a little bit nicer than the other one. You go to school for 4 hours a day, and you play tennis for 6 or 7 hours a day, and that inverse ratio of time in school and tennis made you end up having to give up on school, and it was just an endless kind of intensity to it.
And this contributes to why you've often thought of yourself as hating tennis.
Well, you know, I played tennis for all the wrong reasons throughout my life, and different reasons throughout it, but all the wrong ones. You know, first it was my father, then it was me. In order to get out of this tennis camp, the only way out was to really succeed.
You really wanted to play tennis full time, be on the tennis circuit, and not be stuck in school.
Yes, I wanted out of that academy, and I wanted to quit school because I was intimidated by it, because I was overmatched by it, because I was too tired for it most of the time. And succeeding on the court was my way out. Little did I know I was jumping from the frying pan into the fire, because I succeeded only to find myself on a world stage rebelling in front of the world.
Okay, speaking of rebelling, let me read something that you write in your book. And I'm talking to Andre Agassi, the tennis star who was ranked number one during part of his career. And he's written a new memoir called Open. So during the period when you're in this tennis camp you write about how you rebelled, and you write, "I've mutilated my hair, grown my nails, including one pinky nail that's 2 inches long and painted fire engine red. I've pierced my body, broken rules, busted curfew, picked fist fights, thrown tantrums, cut classes, even slipped into the girls' barracks after hours. I've consumed gallons of whiskey, often while sitting brazenly atop my bunk." And you say, "What more can I do? No one seems to notice my antics anymore." So looking back, why do you think you were doing all of that? Was it a fashion statement or more than that?
It's easy to think it was an attempt for me to stand out, when truly in hindsight, it was an attempt for me to hide. You know, there's no better way to hide than to wear a mullet or a mohawk or attract attention somewhere else. And I was hiding. I was rebelling. And I was fighting the world. I was making a choice to be a fighter.
There's a really funny dash scary part in the book having to do with your hair, and this is in during the French Open in 1990. You were starting to lose your hair, which was a thing in the family. You know, your brother had lost his hair, had started to lose his hair at a very young age, and he found it very upsetting. And now that you are known for this mullet, you are known for your hair, and you're starting to lose it. It's like there goes part of your identity. So you got a hairpiece. You actually got a hairpiece for the top of your head. And then what happened to the hairpiece?
I did. You know, I was terrorized watching my brother lose his hair at an early age. It left an impression on me. Combine that with the fact that my livelihood and my image was so connected to it. I just couldn't bear the thought of the world knowing my dark secret that I was actually losing my hair. So I wore a hairpiece in the French Open during that time, and everything was great the whole tournament, except the night before the finals. I guess I used the wrong conditioner on my hair, and as a result, the weave started to slip loose, and 80% of the hairpiece was kind of flapping in the wind, and I was panicking the night before the finals. What am I going to do, and what am I going to do? And we found a bunch of bobby pins. My brother went out in Paris, and we stuck all these bobby pins in it to kind of clamp it to my real hair and to make sure it holds down, and I was just dreading the possibility that it wouldn't. And I asked my brother, "What do you think? Is it going to hold?" And he basically tells me, "Well, yeah, I think it will if you just don't move around too much."
Oh, very funny.
So we had kind of a dark laugh about that as I go out to play my first Grand Slam final. And it was the only time in my life I ever prayed for a result. And the result wasn't a win. The result was for my hair to stay on, because I didn't know what I would do if that thing came flying off on center court.
So at what point did you decide to cut it off?
I decided to cut it off.
Actually, let me back up and ask you something else. Yeah. How did you keep it on? I mean, just forgetting that night even, but just in general, everyone has seen hair pieces that kind of came loose and got a little twisted and looked a little foolish, and the person wearing it didn't know. And, like, you're sweating like crazy when you're on the court, so how do you keep on a hair piece?
That's why God invented hats and headbands. you know, I first of all, I had some hair. It wasn't like I was this bald guy who was just having this fake hair. I think that looks a bit more extreme. But, you know, I had hair that I could kind of hide around it, and it helped in concealing it to a certain degree. But I always played in from that day forward, I was playing in headbands that could somehow push, you know, hide the base of it. I always went out at night, most of the time wearing baseball caps. And you know, I eventually started to play in just a hat because I got tired of worrying about, you know, its malfunctions and the fact that you have hundreds of photographers taking thousands of pictures through the course of one match. So I did it with hats and a lot of hope that the hat wouldn't come flying off.
So when you cut it off at the suggestion of Brooke Shields, who became your first wife, how did it change of your sense of yourself? Did it make a difference?
It liberated me. I felt like I was free. I felt like it was just a great step forward in my life.
And now you have a shaved head, right?
I shave it every other day.
It looks good.
Thank you. That's very
nice look.
Andre Agassi speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. We'll have more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, where all vehicles are built in zero landfill plants. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count is a state-by-state look at child well-being and the important role of data at aecf.org. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Andre Agassi tells us why he took crystal meth and lied about it. Also, there's a new gangster film out of France about the gangster who was France's public enemy number one in the 60s and 70s. John Powers reviews Meyrine, Killer Instinct. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2009 interview with tennis icon Andre Agassi. He retired in 2006 after winning 8 Grand Slam titles and an Olympic gold medal. His memoir, called Open, now out in paperback, has some big surprises, like his confession that he hates tennis and that he briefly used crystal meth. The memoir is also filled with insights about the game and the physical toll it took on his body, forcing him to retire at the age of 36.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about your longtime coach, Gil, who you met at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, UNLV. And the first time you met him, before he actually started working with you, he gave you some really great advice. Would you describe the advice he gave you?
Well, first of all, to clarify, coach in tennis is kind of a word used for the person that helps you between the lines, and a trainer's kind of designed to be to describe the person that helps you with the physical, nutritional, strength training part of sides. And that's who Gil was. He was a strength trainer in my life, but he was more than that. He was a soul trainer. He was a lifeguard for me. You know, he was just an amazing, amazing person. And one of the things that really impressed me about Gil is he knew nothing about tennis, but he knows everything about the biomechanics and the human body, and he knows a lot about sports in the sense that he's believed right from the beginning that if you have a muscle and you make it stronger, you make it more capable. And he was asking me why I have the training routine I have, why I run 5 miles a day, why I do certain things, and I basically didn't know. And he asked me, "Do you run 5 miles in a tennis match ever?" And I said, "Well, no." He says, "Well, in a tennis match, you have to run maybe 5 or 7 steps before you have to think about slowing down or stopping, else you're going to run right past the ball after you hit it, and you won't be back in position for the next one." And I was like, "Well, yeah, that's right. So you need to accelerate, and then you need to break. So it seems to me like your sport is a lot more about starting and stopping than it is about running." And I said to him, "Gee, that's about the smartest thing I think anybody's ever said to me about tennis." He says, "How about we start to focus on building the muscles that you need to explode, to break, and to dig back out of?" And it was just, all of a sudden it occurred to me that, you know, I had this asset in my life, or access to this asset of understanding my body and being kind of guided and navigating those waters of becoming stronger and fitter.
Was it really terrific to have somebody on your side who could train you, but at the same time didn't have ulterior motives? Like your father, I mean, he was living his fantasy out through you. And then, you know, but in this case, I mean, it sounded like he was really on your side and wanted what was best for you, including for you to play your best game.
Oh, no question. Before we worked together, before we even technically worked together, and he, you know, we bonded and loved each other early in our time spent together, and so much so that when I asked him to work with me formally, the subject of money never came up, and he said, "Well, I absolutely yes." And he says, "But if I'm going to do this, I got to do it a certain way, because I'm not going to risk you. I'm not going to risk your dreams, your hopes, your career." And so he literally set out and built every machine that we trained on with his hands, designed, welded, and built. And it was like my father who built this dragon. You know, it was like, I wondered if it was the only thing he had in common really with my father, because he was such a source of strength, and he taught me that I'm worth caring about. His actions lived. That was the way he lived, is proving to me that I'm worth caring about. And I started to realize I was learning a lot more from Gil than just how to get physically stronger.
In your memoir, you confess something that's really shocked a lot of people, which is that you used crystal meth for a while in 1997. And you actually had a urine test that was done by the ATP, the Association of Tennis Professionals. And you tested positive for crystal meth there. And you lied. You what did you tell them to cover up for the fact that you were actually using at the time?
Yeah, it was a time in my life where I was depressed and didn't know what depression was, and I was disengaged with tennis. I woke up in a life that I realized it wasn't mine. I wasn't connected to. I hated what I did. I was in a marriage I didn't want to be in, and I was depressed. And somebody came along and offered me an escape, and I took it. And for a moment there was vast sadness. And then the drug at least allowed me to feel again for a few moments before it started to, you know, rip away at me like drugs do. And getting caught with it and getting tested positive, I was scared. I was ashamed. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't really confide in anybody because nobody knew. doctor called me and told me I tested positive for, he gave me all these lengthy words of what I had been tested positive to, and I went with my recollection of crystal methylene, not being completely sure what it actually was. I did the only thing I thought to do, and I wrote a letter following the procedure, and I lied about how I ingested the drug. I lied by saying my assistant, who was a drug user, which was true, used to spike his sodas to sometimes conceal his usage, and that was true. And I then went on to say that I drank one of his spiked sodas, and that's how it was in my system, and I begged for leniency and mercy, and sent the letter off, and just absolutely from that day forward, never really able to shake how bad something like that feels. Doing a drug is one thing, you know, it's one thing to make a decision and to have that decision impact you. That's fair enough. You make a choice for yourself and you pay the consequences. But when you start to lie about certain things, you really do run the risk of hurting more than just you. And that part was always hard for me. And I think in many ways from that day forward, I've been trying to atone for it.
Were there consequences for your assistant who you kind of ratted out in your letter? You said that he used meth and that, you know, he spiked his drink that you accidentally drank.
He had already kind of fallen off the radar. He was gone. I watched that drug rip his life apart. He was in a rehab and had already publicly sort of confessed to his circle that he was, you know, dying with this addiction. And so there was nothing private about that part of it, but you know, in the book, I sort of refer to him as Slim, which was also deliberate
to hide his real name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Professionally, I think the question, you know, one of the questions is: did doing meth give you a competitive edge, and should it question the accuracy of your record? What do you think?
Well, I can tell you exactly what it did. It's a performance inhibitor. I mean, it's a deadly, deadly disease that. That destroys you. It destroys you from the moment you take it. It's to take that drug and to think about doing anything physical is nearly impossibility between your heart rate and between your dehydration. It's what our sport demands. It was a beyond a liability. It was a class 2 violation, which is a recreational drug, and it's my belief. Moving forward, that anybody that tests positive for a recreational drug, while there should be rules that are followed and adhered to, instead of judgments or condemnation, that there should be some compassion towards the possibility that this person really has a problem and needs help. And I think that always should be considered because I lived it and I needed help.
Tennis star Andre Agassi speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2009 interview with tennis star Andre Agassi. His memoir, called Open, is now out in paperback.
So we know we were talking earlier about this feeling you had through your tennis career of how, like, you wanted it to end, you didn't want to end, you wanted to retire, you didn't want to retire. But then in 2006, you retired. It was over. And so 3 years into that retirement, how does it feel to not be a professional tennis player?
It feels like a good fit. It was a seamless transition for me. Again, from that day that I lied about taking the drug, you know, that was the day that I was asking for a second chance and got it. And most people don't get that. And I made a commitment to myself, and I made a commitment to all those around me, and that I would make the most of my second chance, that I would atone for this part of my life in a way that'll be real every day. And part of that atonement has been this book. Part of that atonement is also the fact that I was going to play tennis as hard and as long as possible and give as much as I could to it and do everything in the meantime to appreciate its gifts to me. And it gave me my school in Las Vegas. It gave me eventually my wife.
The school is a school that you founded and have helped fund, a charter school for inner city kids.
I built a K-12 public charter school in the poorest neighborhood of Las Vegas, and as a result, these children are going on to lives of their choosing, and it's been my life's work for about 12 years now. But you know, so I just part of that commitment was to see through my career, to not choose to retire, but for retirement to choose me. And I pushed until my body just absolutely couldn't do it anymore. And when I finished that day, I could feel that tape of that finish line snap across my chest. And I went out that night, as recently as that night, and had dinner with a few close people in my life. And I you could see it on my face. And as I look back, I used to think of myself as a moody person. You know, I really did. But I've come to terms with the fact that, you know, tennis is moody. I mean, tennis asks a lot of you every day, and it demands you to be hypersensitive to everything you're feeling and everything that you need to have around you, everything you need to feel to be at your best. And I live a blessed life now, and certainly one of my choice.
Now, when you were playing tennis professionally, you had a trainer who traveled with you, was with you a lot, Gil, who you write about in the book. Do you feel, does it feel different to go through life now without a trainer? You know what I'm saying? Without somebody whose job it is to look after you and give you advice and make sure you're drinking enough water and all that stuff.
Well, Gil still gives me advice. It's just not as often about the body anymore, you know, but we're so close. And what he contributed to me meant more off the court than it ever did on the court. And I still get all the good stuff without the pressures, and there's pressures for him too. You know, he's one mistake in a gym can cost a career, it can cost your dream, it can cost all of it. It was and it's a mistake that can happen at any moment, and every decision is calculated, and it was tiring for him too. I felt the tape snap across his chest as well.
It's interesting, you know, you describe how when you decided to retire in 2006, at the end of the U.S. Open, well, I mean, you knew you were going to retire at the end of the U.S. Open. Your father seemed to want you to retire too. Like, he knew you were in pain. He knew you were done, and he wanted you to be done.
Yeah, I was standing in the lobby of my hotel, and I felt some man come along and put his arm on me and pull me aside, like he always does when he wants to say something to you. And he pulled me aside, and he had tears in his eyes, and he says, you know, don't play, Andre, just quit, go home. You don't need this. You've done it enough. You've proven everything you need to prove. It's over now. I mean, I can't stand it all these years. And he starts going on with watching me over all the years and watching and living and dying with all of it and studying these upcomers and these newcomers. And when there's a tournament in China, he's waking up at certain hours. When it's in Europe, he's going to sleep at certain hours. His whole life was revolved around. In that moment, I looked at him, and it appeared to me for the first time that I saw in him what I've seen in myself, which is he hates tennis. He hasn't really come to terms with his own tortures with this and what this all means. And I just told him, Dad, I can't quit. I haven't quit yet. I had many opportunities to quit, and I never chose it, and I'm not going to choose it today. No matter what that means, going out there on that court, I'm gonna see this through.
When you say he hates tennis, I got the feeling reading that part of your book that what he really hated was watching you suffer, and also maybe knowing what he'd put you through.
I think that's the case, but I think that's part of his emotion. I think the other part is hating how much tennis has gotten in between me and him.
Mm-hmm,
how much tennis has gotten in between, you know, my pains and struggles gotten in between my relationship with myself. I think it was, you know, it was a strong moment that a lot can be read into it. And I wish my father was in touch enough with what he felt to be able to fully communicate it, because it looked powerful and it looked deep and it looked broad, and it you felt like it went to the bone.
So you're married to tennis star Steffi Graf. You're both retired. Do either of you play tennis anymore?
We do occasionally, getting ready for a charity event or something of this nature, and I take her, you know, out in the court, and we both have perfectly aligned goals. She wants to run and get exercise, and I want to stand still. So she hits the ball back to me, and I run her left and right. It's kind of fun.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Tennis star Andre Agassi speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. His memoir, Open, is now out in paperback. This year's U.S. Open starts Monday. You can read excerpts of Agassi's memoir on our website, freshair.npr.org. Here's a sneak peek of what we'll be doing next week on Fresh Air to cope with the unofficial ending of summer. We'll be dipping into our country music archive to play interviews and performances with an array of country stars, including Merle Haggard, Doc Watson, George Jones, Charlie Rich, Waylon Jennings, and Willie Nelson. Here's a preview, an excerpt from Terry's 1996 conversation with Willie Nelson.
Country songs have certain conventions in a way. You know, like a lot of country songs are about cheating or drinking too much or falling in love. I guess you could say the same thing about rock songs. Mm-hmm. But there's also like a subcategory of country songs where like you're feeling so bad, you're just overwhelmed with self-pity. And one of the most self-pitying of the self-pitying songs is a song that you wrote that's included on your demo sessions that I really want to play and hear the story behind. And so here it comes. This is Willie Nelson singing a very self-pitying song.
If I'd only had one arm to hold you, better yet, if I'd had none at all, then I wouldn't have two arms that ache for you, and there'd be one less memory to recall. If I'd only.
Then in the next verse, you imagine having only one eye, so he'd have only one eye to cry. Did you think of
that's
the song?
That's pitiful, isn't it?
Yes, so self-pitying. did you think that when you sat down to write this, that you would write the ultimate self-pitying song?
Well, actually, I didn't sit down to write that one. The way that song happened, I was lying in bed with Shirley, and I woke up in the middle of the night wanting a cigarette, and her head was on my arm. So I had to reach over on the side of the bed and get a cigarette and put it in my mouth and then get a match with that one hand and then try to strike that one match. So it all started from that.
Oh, because you only had one arm? Really? Is this really what
happened? That's true. That's a true story. So from the one arm, I went into the one eye, one ear, one leg.
That's really funny.
If I only had one leg to stand on, then a much truer picture you'd see. For then I'd more closely resemble the half a man that you've made of me.
We'll hear more of that interview with Willie Nelson during Country Music Week next week on Fresh Air. Coming up, critic-at-large John Powers on a French film about one of that country's more notorious criminals. This is Fresh Air. Vincent Cassel is a French actor whose work in English includes Ocean's 12 and 13. He soon will be seen in Darren Aronofsky's The Black Swan with Natalie Portman and in David Cronenberg's new film about Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. Cassel is best known in France for playing explosive types and scored a huge critical and box office hit as legendary gangster Jacques Mérine in a 4-hour, 2-part biographical drama. The first part, Mérine Killer Instinct, opens today in the United States. Our critic at large, John Powers, says that Cassel alone is worth a trip to the movies.
Americans have long had a love affair with gangsters, be it John Dillinger or The Godfather or Tony Soprano. But we're not the only ones. In London, you hear awestruck talk about the murderous brothers Reggie and Ronnie Cray. Go to Medellin and the name Pablo Escobar is spoken with an eerie reverence. And if you find yourself in Paris, don't be surprised to see some hip-hop kid wearing a t-shirt with an image of Jacques Mérine, who in the 60s and 70s proudly wore the label of Public Enemy Number 1, until the police gunned him down and made him immortal. Equal parts thug and self-styled pop icon, Mérine, or Mesrine, as was pronounced by his enemies, is the hero of a 2-part gangster saga that's already taken France by storm. The first movie, Mérine Killer Instinct, is just coming out here. And although it's accurate, Mérine killed 39 people, such a lethal title doesn't do justice to the movie's exuberance, comedy, and even warmth. Vincent Cassel stars as Mérine, a rebellious child of privilege who, turning his back on his family's prosperity, becomes a racist soldier. Early on, we see him shoot an Algerian prisoner, then later a small-time crook. Soon, he starts working for a Parisian crime boss, Guido, delicately played by Gérard Depardieu, and this means committing bigger crimes. No problem. A born showman, Mérine wreaks havoc with panache, finding his match in a young woman, Jeanne Schneider, played by Cécile de France. She becomes Bonnie to his Clyde. Naturally, possessing a killer instinct is a good way of getting killed yourself, and eventually the lovers wind up fleeing to Canada. In Quebec, Mérine gets thrown into a brutal, famously escape-proof prison from which, inevitably, he escapes, beginning his legend as the outlaw that no prison could hold. This escape becomes the launching pad for the second Mérine film, called Public Enemy Number 1. There is, of course, a grand tradition of gangster movies in France, probably reaching its peak in the work of Jean-Pierre Melville. But here, director Jean-François Richer's juiced-up style seems steeped in rollicking American pictures like Goodfellas. Clearly bored by psychological and sociological analysis, he's more eager to entertain you than to make you think. Killer Instinct is most enjoyable as a French-style character study that seeks to show us Mérine in all his aspects. We see the ruthless crook, sure, but we also see the laughing hedonist who digs sex and partying, the underworld acolyte loyal to Depardieu's Guido, the suburban kid still driven nuts by his folks, the ardent lover burning with passion for his Jeanne, and the charmer famous for being able to win over anybody, including cops and prison guards. It's the essence of a good movie gangster that he attracts us even as he repels us. And Cassel, whose eyes can switch from lazy to lethal as quickly as a tiger's, carries himself with the effortless ease of one for whom crime is the vital element in which he swims. He gives a thrilling, full-court press of a performance, and I'm not joking when I say that his work ranks with the best of De Niro, or Pacino, or more recently Daniel Day-Lewis. Cassel's Mérine is magnificently alive. Now, the allure of gangster tales has always been that they satisfy both our id and our superego. Mérine's story lets us follow, even identify with, an amoral man who acts out the giddy antisocial impulses that society has taught most of us to suppress. At the same time, gangster stories also provide the reassurance of knowing that we aren't foolish in following the rules. The Dillingers, Escobars, and Mérines may have their soaring moments, but they inevitably come crashing back to earth. Doom is in their DNA. It certainly was in Mérine's. But fate's morality play doesn't catch up with him until the second movie, which is one reason this first one is so exciting and unsettling. As Jacques Mérine robs and kills and thumbs his nose at authority, he offers a portrait of taboo-busting freedom that's easy to envy when we're not averting our eyes from the violence that is the price of such freedom.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Saab, for people who have a different perspective on driving. Learn more at saabusa.com. Saab, move your mind. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we kick off our Country Music Week with Jimmy Dale Gilmore, who will perform classic country songs.
Pick me up on your way down when you're blue and all alone.
And we'll hear an interview with jazz composer and bassist Charlie Hayden, who grew up in a country music family and returned to that music for a recent recording. Join us.
Pride and joy, but they'll find another toy, and they'll take over.